Welcome to the CB Wallet Podcast. I'm Phil Lucas.
And I'm Phil Jarrett. Why are we here, Phil?
Well, we're going to talk about the greatest disasters in world history and some that you may never have heard of. What went wrong, how it went wrong, and whether it was our fault or God's fault.
What a bloody marvellous idea that is, Phil. Great idea. But remember, Phil, it is not our intention to make light of the sometimes quite substantial mortality rates of some of these disasters, is it, Phil?
No.
Just interested in finding out what went wrong. And be honest with yourself, Phil, if it came on the news, I reckon you'd be interested, wouldn't you, you lonely knob tickler?
Breaking news, chocolate or diesel trains, Phil. Difficult to know which one I'm more addicted to.
What are we wanging on about this week?
The Hartford Circus fire.
All the sawdust. And this tent with three big poles. We didn't have the best seats. We had seats on the side. We could either sit on the right or the left. And we didn't know where to go. And I said, Donald, let's go on this side because we can go higher. And we got to the highest bleacher. Wow. And the first act was the animal act. Wild animals, lions and tigers, and the crack of the whip and the sword that flew up. Look, Donald! And then a hush fell over the tent because the greatest circus act in the world was going to come and perform next. The Flying Walendas, they were famous the world over. And they came out, they had beautiful yellow costumes, all feathers, and they were carrying chairs on their shoulders and they made pyramids. Look, they're going to walk all across the three rings without a net. And this beautiful acrobat with a headdress of yellow feathers, when she stepped on the wire, Donald screamed, fire, fire! And the voice in my head said, jump, jump, Donald, and I jumped. And we ran to the other end of the tent, and we ran to the edge of the parking lot and turned around, and it was gone. Donald, the tent is gone.
Circus, Phil! The roar of the grease paint! The smell of the crowd!
They're shit, aren't they, circuses?
I think I have never been to one, so they could be the greatest thing of all time, to be honest. When was the last time you went to a circus?
I think the last time I went to a circus, Harold Wilson was probably Prime Minister.
You're kidding me.
Actually, no, tell a lie, probably Jim Callaghan. So that would put it somewhere between 1976 and 1979, I would say.
Do you remember anything about your circus experience?
God, almighty, I mean, it was so long ago. I mean, I think it's as you would expect. It's like going to one of the, not the main stage at Glastonbury. It's like going to one of the other tents.
I tell you what, mate, it's like going to the circus tent.
Yes, exactly.
That's what it's mostly like.
But instead of seeing Mika or something, you're seeing a big elephant on a small stool lifting its leg up with a hat on.
There's a lot of cruelty that went into the circus. And I think that some of that cruelty that nobody ever talks about is I worry about wage disparity. Does that ever bother you?
So we're not necessarily talking gender here, we're talking...
I'll tell you what we're talking about. Imagine that you spend, you know, the whole of your life trying to do a high wire trapeze act and you're getting paid the same as a bearded lady. You'd be fucked off, wouldn't you? You'd be like, my husband's got no legs because he fell off the high wire. You're just walking around with a hairy face and we're still getting paid 50 quid each.
That would actually be a very interesting thing to find out, the wage structure of a circus.
They must have given them wages dependent on skill and ability.
They must have done. But like you say, the irony there is if that's the case, then the high wire people would be probably receiving more money than a freak. And a freak is the thing that everyone wants to see because that's our nature.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? If you say like, well, okay, well, I should get paid so much because I'm putting my life in danger, right? And then the head of the circus goes, yes, you might be putting your life at risk every night, but I tell you who they're coming to see, Gloria, because she's got a hairy face.
And there you have nurses and footballers in a nutshell and why the world works the way it does.
Isn't that terrible? But that is totally true, isn't it?
Yep.
Anyway, Phil, so this is a circus episode. But I think before we get into the circus episode, Phil, this episode, I mean, it's a great episode, Phil. You've done an absolute fucking bang-up job here.
Thank you.
It's like the evil alter ego of Escape from Monkey Mountain, isn't it?
Oh, God, it's awful.
I mean, it's got to be up there in the top five worst ones we've ever done, I think.
I think you're right. I mean, as I was writing this, I just kept going, oh, E. It really was quite a shock doing this one.
It's shocking. It is properly shocking. And another thing about it is for somebody who is absolutely against doing Aberfan, the Welsh mining disaster, I mean, in any way, there might be sort of gradations of how bad a disaster can be. This has got to be on a level with Aberfan, hasn't it? I mean...
Well, yes, but there are two factors that come into play. One, it's nearly 80 years ago.
Oh, yeah, good point, yeah.
And two, it's the other side of the world.
Well, not to people who are listening to this in America, there isn't. But yes, I take the point. But trigger warning, this does involve the death of children in possibly the worst way that you could imagine, as I imagine. So if you like the circus, this is going to ruin the circus.
But fortunately, Phil, it's all right because nobody likes the circus because they're rubbish.
Yes, and I wouldn't have thought this can this can't happen again, can it, surely?
I don't think so.
But yes, all I'm trying to say is proceed with caution.
Yeah.
Okay, Phil, the Hartford Circus Fire of 1944, what was that?
It was a very big fire at a circus in the big top of that circus.
When did it happen?
July the 6th, 1944.
And how many people died, Phil?
168, as far as we know. Could have been a few more, but it's about 168.
Okay, fine. Now, don't need to explain what circus is, do we, Phil? Great big bell-shaped bit of canvas filled with dickheads. But...
That's it, Phil. You've hit it in a nutshell. We do not need to explain a circus. Rubbish entertainment, popular before the internet, where animals who were subjected to dubious welfare standards did tricks and flips for punters. Dwarfs were fired out of cannons and clowns weren't funny consistently.
Clowns are unique in that they have... They have served two functions in their life over the years, clowns, right? Neither of which they have fulfilled. So for the first, let's say, 1,000 years, clowns were supposed to be funny, and they weren't.
No.
And then somewhere around 1980, people said, oh, clowns aren't funny, they're scary. And now clowns are scary, and they're not! So... Phil, you said this disaster happened in Hartford, Connecticut. I know you did because I was here when you said it. Where's Hartford, Connecticut? I think I've heard of it.
Right. Get your big map of America out, Phil. Lay it in front of you, yeah? Have you done that?
Yup.
Find New York.
Got it here.
Now, imagine New York is right at the centre of your clock.
Yep.
Right, now start walking as if you were going towards the number one of your clock.
Yep.
After 118 miles, you would come to that number one. And that is Hartford. It's eastern USA, not a million miles from the coast, and about halfway between New York and Boston. And old Phil sitting over here, I have done the train between New York and Boston, so I've probably passed it and not even realised.
How sick do you think the people of Boston are of the Cheers theme tune?
I'll tell you one thing about Boston. I've never been to a city with so many animal statues.
Oh, well, they've got animal statues.
But I think they're just nice people. You go down one road, there's a frog fishing.
Oh.
You go down another road, there's a little hare thumping his head. It's a great city.
Lovely. Anything worthy we should know about Hartford, apart from the fact that it's close to Boston?
Well, Phil, yeah. I mean, there's the boring stuff I could tell you. Like, it's the capital city of Connecticut with a population of 125,000.
Quite small.
Or I could tell you that it contains the USA's oldest museum. And Mark Twain, he said of the city, "Of all the beautiful towns it has been my fortune to see, this is the chief. You do not know what beauty is if you have not been here."
I bet it looks bloody lovely at this time of year around that area of America. All autumnal, all lovely oranges and all sorts of nice bit of crisp in the air. Oh, lovely.
Anyway, Phil, I could tell you all those facts. They're boring. I could do better than that. Check out these. Every one of these is a belter.
Fact me one time.
Hartford was the first place in the world where laughing gas was used as an anaesthetic in dentistry. 1844, that happened.
It's called laughing gas because it literally makes people laugh. So were they pissing themselves while they were doing their dentistry?
No, I don't think the dentist is given laughing gas, Phil. I think it's the patient.
I knew that. What I mean is that they did used to laugh, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. Nitrous oxide, isn't it? Yeah.
Which is just another reason why the past was just so much better than now. You don't do any medical procedure pissing yourself laughing now, do you? Like, back in the old days, you know, if you were going to have a leg off, they'd give you a nip of whiskey. They don't do that now, do they? Bullshit.
No.
Fat me two times.
The first ever witchcraft execution happened in Hartford in 1647. Poor lady, she was called Alice Young.
Shit, was she burned?
Yes, and one of the very, very first ones in the USA as well.
Do you know, not many witches were burned. It's a myth. They always think we'll be burned. The thing about that is, I think they were mainly hung, right? Or drowned. A lot of witches drowned.
Drowned, yeah.
But it's the popular image is burned, isn't it? But it's not one of those things where you go, oh, do you know, actually, not a lot of witches were burned. Because you can always come back with, yeah, but some witches were burned though, weren't they? Like, it's still like double figures or something.
I've been watching the news for the last year and we haven't changed much, have we?
That need that human beings have to other somebody in some way and then purge them from society to cure whatever sins they believe society has is hardwired, right? Never getting away from that.
Yeah. All we are now is Neanderthals with iPhones.
Yes, exactly. We have the same needs. They've absented into different sort of places, but it's the same itch that's being scratched.
Monkeys will always wank.
Monkeys, that's right. We're neurotic wanking monkeys, and it's never going to change.
When I was a kid, yeah, and you heard about people being burned at the stake, I genuinely thought they were burned next to, like, a piece of meat.
Really?
I didn't know what a steak was. And I never understood why they would be burnt next to a piece of meat.
Just trying to use the energy. Well, we've got the fire, so we may as well have a bit of dinner. And a similar vein, there is a song by a band called Steel Eye Span, I think.
Oh, yes, 70s band, weren't they?
Yes, a 70s band, a sort of hippy-dippy 70s band. And they have a very famous song called Meat on the Ledge. And for ages, I thought that was a bit of meat on a ledge. And I was like, why are they singing about that? But they, of course, mean that we are going, you and me should meet on the ledge, not, oh, look at that over there. Someone has left some meat on that ledge. Fact me three times? These are good facts, Phil.
They are, aren't they? Hartford's come up trumps. The automatic pistol was invented in Hartford. A chap called John M. Browning. I think we've heard of the Browning pistol, yeah.
Is this Wild West? Is this like, is it a sort of gun that you'd twirl round your middle finger?
That's it, it's one of those.
Colt and Browning, they're the guns I know. And Luger.
Luger, oh, I loved a Luger as a kid.
It's weird that a Luger looks like an evil gun, doesn't it?
Yeah. Do you think it's because it's Nazis had Lugers?
It is, definitely, because it's connected to Nazis, isn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas, like, these guns used to have names like Peacemaker, didn't they?
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Fact me four times.
In 2006, the city of Hartford launched an advertising campaign to entice young people to move there. One of the promotions included a billboard that read, "Come to Hartford. I swear it's fun."
I mean, I got to say, Hartford sounds pretty cool.
Well, we're both very old.
I mean, it sounds pretty good if you're into guns, witches and dentistry. Which, as you know, I am.
No, it does sound really nice, actually. And I've travelled a little bit around that part of the world. And it's lovely. It's awesome.
Great stuff, Philip Lucas. You've absolutely nailed that. That's all we need to know about Hartford, Connecticut. The number one on the clock if you walk from New York. So tell me about this circus fire, Phil. Tell me everything now, immediately. Don't leave anything out. I mean it, Phil. Don't gloss over the cracks of this one, mate, because we may as well do it. If we're going to do it, Phil, we may as well do it.
Shall I do it?
Do it, Phil.
Well, Phil, as we said earlier, this disaster happened on the 6th of July 1944.
Right.
And, Phil, how did this 6th of July start?
This 6th of July 1944 started like any other.
Apart from the fact that America were in the middle of a huge world war, obviously, 1944 and all that.
Oh, yeah.
But that doesn't concern us here, Phil, because we're here to talk about circus. Now, no, we're not talking about the war. There may have been a war going on, and many young men will have been conscripted away from their homeland to face unimaginable hardships and possible death on the other side of the world. But people, Phil, will always need clowns.
Absolutely.
So in Hartford, Connecticut, there was a circus in town. Now, in mid-20th century America, a typical circus travelled from town to town by train, performing under a huge canvas tent commonly known as a big top. So, it's a bit like what you see here today, Phil. Although, I don't know about you, Phil, but I'm always very dubious when I see the Moscow State Circus in town, because I look at all the trucks with their British registrations, and I am convinced that everything connected with that circus is about as Russian as a boomerang or sweet and sour chicken.
Yeah, exactly. It is the chicken tikka masala of travelling circus.
It really is, isn't it? But these people are not pretending to be Russian. This is Hartford, Connecticut in 1944. There's no Reds Under the Bed circus here. This is a circus fill brought to the good people of the city by the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus.
The most famous circus of all time.
Yeah, not the most pithy name, but the most famous circus.
It's Barnum, innit?
Everyone knows Barnum, don't they?
What's the famous Barnum saying? Does it give the dickheads what they want? What is it? Oh, there's a sucker born every minute, is Barnum saying, isn't it?
Is it? Oh, I thought it was the greatest show on earth, but there you go.
It's both. I think he said one out loud and the other he said just at home.
So the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, not the most pithy name for a circus, that one, Phil.
No.
And that's because it had quite a complex history.
Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, also known as the Ringling Brothers Circus, Barnum and Bailey Circus, Ringling Brothers, Barnum and Bailey, or simply Ringling, was an American travelling circus company billed as the greatest show on earth. It and its predecessor shows ran from 1871 to 2017. Known as Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey combined shows, the circus started in 1919 when the Barnum and Bailey Greatest Show on Earth, a circus created by P.T. Barnum and James Anthony Bailey, was merged with the Ringling Brothers, World's Greatest Shows. The Ringling Brothers had purchased Barnum and Bailey Limited following Bailey's death in 1906, but ran the circuses separately until they were merged in 1919.
I think I could pick up Latin quicker than I would understand that.
So essentially, the name is coming from a lot of sort of backwards and forwards circus deals. Backroom circus mergers.
Phil, can I give you a little fact about Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, please?
I don't see why not.
In 1938, guess who their special guest star was for all of their touring shows?
Hitler!
No! Cast your mind back two episodes, Phil.
Fuck off, really?
It's only Frank Buck!
That's amazing.
Yes! Our man Frank, right, was to be the star attraction for the whole of the 1938 touring season.
I'm going to be the star attraction. That's how he talks, didn't he? Those monkeys and the trees. I only realised that's how Frank Buck talked when I put the clips on that episode. But he's got this really weird sort of Elvis-like voice.
You actually sound quite like Donald Trump there, to be honest with you.
Yeah, he sounds like... Frank Buck did sound a bit like Donald Trump.
Yeah, it was a really great elephant, one of the best elephants. Phenomenal elephant. Yes, our man Frank was to be the star attraction for the whole of the 1938 touring season, and he was to enter the show astride an elephant.
Was the whole of the 1938 touring season cancelled halfway through when all of the animals escaped?
They all escaped off Elephant Hill.
Yeah, that's right. Because Frank Buck doesn't know that elephants have knees.
Now, Phil, to be able to perform this simple task of elephant riding, yeah, Frank Buck had to join the American Federation of Actors, a union, obviously, which is something that he flatly refused to do, stating...
I'm a scientist. I'm not an actor.
Now...
Go back, if you haven't listened to the Escape from Monkey Mountain episode, go back and listen, because that's how he talks. It's the weirdest accent. It sounds like if Elvis had just tried to climb some stairs. Like old Elvis had gone upstairs and given you a ring. Oh, hi.
So, he wouldn't get on the elephant. The trouble is there was a threat of a circus strike if Buck did not join the union. But despite this, Frank maintained that he would not compromise his principles, saying...
I don't want some union delegate telling me when to get on and off an elephant.
Which is a beautiful phrase. But eventually, a compromise was reached where Buck didn't ride into the show on an elephant, but instead appeared by introducing Gargantua the gorilla, which, to the best of our knowledge, he never rode.
So the fact that they were planning legal action if Frank Buck didn't join the union because he was going to ride an elephant, that makes it sound to me that they were really hot on pay and conditions for the different people. So I bet they did have tiered pay.
Oh, they probably did, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's probably one of those, like, all in the union or none in the union scabs and all that stuff.
Would you cross a clown picket line? You push one over, they all fall over.
Do you think Frank Buck secretly oiled the elephants that he refused to ride?
That's why he refused to ride them. He goes, I'm not riding those elephants because I've oiled them so much, I will slip off.
If you haven't listened to our episode, Escape from Monkey Mountain, then do listen, because oiling the elephants will make sense.
No, it won't. It will never make sense. Anyway, back to Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey. They must have been able to, you know, acroname it. What, RBABABC?
Oh, yeah, that just drops off the tongue, doesn't it?
RBABABC. Okay. So, Phil, the Ringling Brothers of Barnum and Bailey Circus arrived in Hartford, Connecticut, only 2 years after most of their animals were killed in a fire at their menagerie.
Nice.
They had a bit of form with them setting fire to animals, the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus. I bet there's an awful lot of circus mishaps because, you know, I imagine they're, I don't want to say badly run, but certainly chaotic places to work.
Well, it's not a solicitor's, is it?
It's not a solicitor's. Nobody gets upset with their parents, runs away to join the solicitors, does it? I've had it with you guys. I'm putting a sandwich in a handkerchief on a stick and I'm running away to Black, Brown and Peabody. But nobody was thinking of the last time a circus went up in Hartford, Connecticut. They were thinking of the future, Phil.
Oh!
They were thinking of clowns with big shoes, Phil.
Yes.
Elephants balancing on little stools and of how any of this was going to be remotely exciting to anybody in the coming atomic age.
You're not wrong.
And let's not forget, Phil, circuses in 1944 weren't like circuses are now, right? Where nobody goes to them and nobody cares about them.
Right.
You need to imagine a time in the world where circuses were popular. I know it's mad, right? Just like the cinema, people used to go. Incredible. In 1944, the circus coming to town was a big event, Phil.
Right.
It would make front page news.
Wow.
Children would be counting the days down until the circus came to town. And the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus was considered one of, if not, Phil, the best circus in the world.
Wow.
Now, the accolades of the best circus in the world now, you could get just by putting a tent up in the garden and doing a bit of juggling, probably. But in those days, that actually meant something. Now, these circuses would have thousands of people in the audience.
That's thousands more than they'd have now.
Yes, that's, I'd say, that is at least thousands more.
You've gone from front page news and children physically counting down and ticking the days off their calendar to some bloke walking around the local shops going, do you want to put this poster up in an off-licence, mate? We've got a circus coming. I'll give you a couple of tickets.
You know that bit of town where people usually take drugs? Well, for one weekend in the summer, there's going to be a tent on it. Okay. But from the off, Phil, their visit to Hartford had not gone smoothly. Small things started to go wrong before the main event. The circus was due in town for their first performance on the evening of the 5th of July, Phil. That's one day before our disaster. But problems and delays with trains and stuff getting there. Don't forget, there was a war on, Phil, so everything was a little bit muddled.
Yeah.
It meant that they arrived very late into the city. Not enough time to put the tent up, really. They were so late, in fact, that they had to cancel their performance for the evening of the 5th of July because they just weren't ready. They couldn't put the tent up. They couldn't get the elephants in. Right? Too dark, mate. Now, you know what theatrical types are like, don't you?
Mm.
Everything's an omen, isn't it, to a theatre type?
Yeah.
And in circus superstition, Phil, missing a show is considered extremely bad luck.
Oh, right.
So, I mean, 2020 has been very bad luck, I should imagine, for circus people. And there was this idea in sort of a circus folklore that something very bad would happen if you miss a show. Now, that's how the chat went down if you're a clown or one of the paid freaks or something like that. But let's be honest about this. if you take a step back, this does seem a little bit more likely to be a superstition that has come about because some clever circus owner has realised that missing a show means losing money.
So, yeah.
Okay. Oh, it's terribly bad luck to miss a show. Very bad. You know, it's also very bad luck not to do two shows on a Saturday. You realise that? Put your slap shoes on.
Get out there, Coco!
Okay, so it might have been a bit of mystical humbug to save a few quid and rule the performance with a rod of iron. I imagine for all of the sort of fucking about that you would have done if you'd gone away to join the circus, I bet it was a pretty harsh lifestyle.
I bet it was hard graft. One minute you're mucking out the elephants, the next minute you're welcoming people on the door, and then you've got to go and be fired out of a cannon.
Exactly.
They multitask, don't they, the circus performers? You see some glamorous high wire act and you go, I'm sure that's the person that showed me to my seat half an hour ago.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. It doesn't feel like you get much respect either, does it? You know, no. you wouldn't walk into a coffee shop in Hartford, Connecticut, and somebody go, oh, did I see you getting a custard pie in the face yesterday? Oh, can I have a photograph? Anyway, the circus couldn't do their 5th of July evening show as the nub and crux of this whole caboodle, Phil. They were too late. The trains were too late because of the frickin' war. So they binned that and they got ready for their July the 6th matinee show instead.
Right.
What this meant, Phil, was that all of the employees, the clowns, the people who ride the elephants, the people who wash the elephants, the people who are putting up all the rings,
oiling the elephants,
tightening the straps, putting on leotards,
combing the lion's mane,
the ringmaster's taking all the cocaine. They were running around like crazy trying to catch up. I mean, I imagine circus people don't take a great deal of effort in the 1940s to make sure everything's safe. But because they're playing catch up, they're probably taking even less effort to try and make sure that everything is tip top. And one of the things that they didn't really put much effort into was dealing with the fire extinguishers.
Mm.
They had fire extinguishers in the big top. And they were supposed to be all around the big top like you would have normal fire extinguishers. But because they were playing catch-up, on this first matinee performance, they left the fire extinguishers unpacked in a big crate just outside the big top.
Well, what's the worst that could happen?
This is terrible, right? But they did have a lot to do. It is the biggest circus tent in the world they had to put up for a matinee performance. So they had the morning to do it.
They didn't have time to worry about fire extinguishers.
And what are the chances? You know, you're a touring circus company. You've done this at least once a day, every day. Do you know what I mean? For years. What are the chances the one day you don't put the fire extinguishers out? The day you need them.
Are you essentially condoning what they did there, Phil?
I'm not condoning. I think if there's a possibility that your tent could go on fire, then you should always put your fire extinguishers out. All I'm really saying is that there is a big dollop of bad luck here. Now, this tent, Phil, right? I don't want you to go away thinking this was just some two-man dome tent. Right?
Ooh.
This tent was 160 metres long,
wow,
65 metres wide and 15 metres tall.
That is truly a big top.
That is one of the biggest tops you're likely to come across.
In those days.
And it was largely made of canvas. And you know the thing about canvas, Phil? Canvas needs constant waterproofing. Makes you wonder why we use it for tents, really. But you need to constantly waterproof canvas to make sure that the punters inside the big top all stay dry. But there was a war on, Phil. And you know what happens when there's a war on? All of the important chemicals all get used up for the important war effort. All of your lotions, potions and solutions that are needed for the war effort, they all get used up, right?
Mm.
So what the circus people did is that they fell back on the older, you know, well, in Grandad's day, they didn't have all these potions and solutions. And they fell back on the old ways of making sure the tent was waterproof.
Very resourceful, probably better, I bet.
The old ways are always better, aren't they, Phil? And in this case, do you want to know what the old way of waterproofing your tent was?
Yes, please.
They got 820 kilograms of paraffin wax and they mixed that with 6,000 gallons of petrol. Right.
That is two words I don't want to hear in the same sentence for safety, gasoline and paraffin.
What they did is they then saturated the whole of the 165 metre long tent with that highly flammable gloop of doom, 820 kilograms of paraffin wax mixed with 6,000 gallons of gasoline. I mean, yes, that's where we are. So the circus rolled into town late, A. B, they forgot to put the fire extinguishers out. And C, they had pretty much just doused the whole of the big tent in petrol. I mean, this sounds insane, right? But that's where we are.
God almighty.
Having got all those things in position, they're now ready to welcome about 7,000 to 8,000 people for their matinee performance on the 6th of July.
Wow.
Now, Phil, 6th of July was an extremely hot summer's day in Connecticut. I bet it was bloody lovely.
Mm.
As you would expect, Phil, in 1944, where there was a world war on, the audience that day was, and there's no other way of saying this other than straight out, 2/3 women and children.
Mm.
Now, like I said, there were somewhere between 7,000 to 8,000 people in the audience. So, nobody will ever really know the exact number. But whichever way you look at it, that is a huge amount of people inside a gasoline-doused tent.
It really is.
And most of those people would have been children.
Oh,
So the show got started at 2:20 p.m., Phil. 2:20? I mean, okay. Sharp at 2:20. We go on stage at 2:21, not a moment later.
I actually think it was 2:23. I just think I rounded it down.
What do you mean? Even you rounded it down. 2:23, and we get the lines out. And it was the usual crap you'd expect. Trapeze artists, clowns, animal trainers. And there was a clown called Emmett Kelly, who was supposed to be the best in the business, Phil, as much as you can be the best clown in the business. And his character name was Weary Willy.
Oh, that's something I can relate to as 50 years old.
Do you think that's encoded in the name? Do you think that's it? It's one of those wonderful jokes that kids won't get, but adults go, I see what you're doing, Weary Willy.
Although, I don't know, actually. We'll have to ask our American listeners. Is Willy a euphemism for cock?
Willy in Britain means penis, doesn't it? It's penis, Phil. Have you heard penis? Heard of that?
I've heard of it, but I don't believe in it.
I was born with trousers on. Congratulations, Mrs. Gerard. It's a gentleman.
Once a month for Jesus.
If Americans thought that the word Willy also meant penis, they wouldn't have made a film called Free Willy.
Mm.
I don't think Will Smith would have written an album called Big Willy Style if they knew.
Willy Wonka. Well, that's British though, isn't it?
That's Roald Dahl. I wonder if Roald Dahl used to have a writing shed at the end of his garden. Right, so he would go down to the shed, yes, and he would be on his own all day.
Where he could just spend all day being anti-Semitic when nobody knew.
Yeah, that's right. And also, what the chances do you reckon Sophie Dahl wandered down one day and where he was talking about his Willy Wonka to himself and he just had to come up with something quickly. He's got his back to her going, Willy, Willy Wonka. Oh no, it's a sort of factory, a chocolate factory. Oh God, no.
I was scattering birdseed, darling.
Just wait outside for a moment. Just a moment, darling. Daddy's writing another book. It's no coincidence that book's about murdering children, isn't it? Oh, fucking, I'll teach you to knock on the door while I'm having a Willy Wonka. Right. Back to this horrific story.
Right.
Not long into the show, Phil, just as, in fact, the 7,000-strong crowd had enjoyed the performing Big Cats under the tutelage of French lion tamer Alfred Kurt. The famous highwire act, the Great Wallanders. I think I've heard of them as well. This is a famous circus, isn't it?
They're still going, I think, the Great Wallanders.
I've definitely heard of them. I think they're a dynasty, aren't they, the Great Wallanders?
Yeah, I think they've had a fair few fatal falls over the years.
I bet they have, yeah. And in fact, you know, Big Cats as well have caused some pretty impressive disasters over the years. I don't think it really falls within our remit, but we could do Siegfried and Roy.
Yeah.
The thing about this podcast is that they almost feel better when more than one person dies. Because if one person dies, it feels a bit personal, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But when lots of people die, somehow it's easier to take. I don't know why.
It's the old Stalin quote, isn't it? The death of one man is a tragedy. The death of millions is a statistic.
Yes, I think that's what it is. Even though it's said by Stalin, I think there's a definite truth in that. Anyway, it was at this point, Phil, that the circus band leader, a man called Merle Evans, but who was known in the trade as the Toscanini of the Big Top, spotted a small spot of flames in the corner just south of the main entrance into the tent.
Right.
To this day, Phil, nobody knows how those flames started. Never been cleared up, but flames they were.
Right.
The most popular theory was a tossed cigarette. Usually is, isn't it? But I reckon when Merle Evans spotted a developing fire, he probably was not thinking about how it started. He was probably thinking,
no.
Fucking hell, we put a lot of petrol on that. Merle Evans, he was very quick thinking, Phil.
Well, he was the Toscanini of the Big Top.
He immediately directed the band to play the Stars and Stripes Forever. Now, the tune, the Stars and Stripes Forever, in Circus Land is a secret code, and it means that something has gone very, very wrong with the show. And it's right. Like on the London Underground, for American listeners, if you're on the London Underground, if you hear the announcement, would Inspector Sands please report to Platform 2? There is no Inspector Sands, but if you hear the name Inspector Sands, I'd say make for an exit.
You do hear that a bit, don't you? You know, and it's not always like, would Inspector Sands report to Platform 2? It's, would Inspector Sands come to the control room?
Well, I think, I don't know this, and we'll have a look at this. There's definitely a terrorism one, and there's definitely a fire one. But I wonder if Inspector Sands is someone's been sick. Because they put sand on it.
Because you cover it up with sand.
You cover it up with sand. So instead of going, oh, someone's thrown up on Platform 2, it's all down a fucking wall, somebody get a bag of sand.
Would Commander Rucksack come to the operations office?
Incidentally, in the circus world, the emergency code song for the Stars and Stripes Forever is referred to as a disaster march.
Oh, nice.
How does the Stars and Stripes Forever go?
Goes exactly like this, Phil.
Merle Evans deserves a little bit of respect here, because it's only because of Merle Evans' quick reactions that thousands of lives were saved.
Well, I've said it before, he wasn't known as a Toscanini at a big top for nothing.
Merle had taken up his baton and ordered his musicians to let rip on the disaster march, and that alerted the circus staff and performers immediately. They were like, fucking, what's gone on, right? Mm. Some of them spotted a developing fire and started to pour buckets of water on it. But that didn't do very much, because, I mean, it's doused in petrol, so you know. You know what would have done, what would have helped at this point, this early stage of the disaster? Fire extinguishers would have been awesome at this point. The fire started building extremely quickly, and it was becoming increasingly obvious that this had the potential to be a very serious fire very, very quickly. Mm. So, as you would expect, they had a ringmaster in the Barnum Circus, a man called Mr. Fred Bradner, and he did what you would imagine a ringmaster would do in any sort of situation, and urged the audience not to panic and to leave the big top in an orderly fashion. You know, where something's gone a little bit wrong, ladies and gentlemen, women and children first.
Yeah, we've got it all under control.
Now, like a lot of these disasters, bad luck is a big factor. Unfortunately, at that precise moment, they had a power failure in the tent, and nobody could hear what he was saying.
And I think that's completely unrelated as well. I don't think it was like the fire ripping through the electricity power cables. They just lost power to the mic.
What an absolute kick in the balls. So instead of leaving in an orderly fashion, the audience, who could now see the flames getting higher and higher, they started to panic. Mm. And they all started to rush to leave the tent at the same time. Mm. It was going to cause panic one way or another, wasn't it? You know, yeah. I don't think a bloke carrying a whip dressed in a shiny red suit with a big showy hat telling you to be orderly is really going to cut it.
No.
People are now trying to leave the tent, orderly or otherwise, right? But it wasn't actually, I know it's a tent, but it actually wasn't that easy to leave.
Right.
Because although the big top had 9 exits, you could only realistically get out of 3 of them.
Oh, Jesus.
2 exits on the north side of the tent had been used by the circus for the caging tunnels. So they've got big cages in with animals in them. They're all blocked up.
Oh, they're like the runs. Yeah. So the animals actually sit outside the big top.
Yeah.
But when they're needed, they kind of come through a like long run, don't they, into the...
Yes, that's right. You can imagine a circus, can't you? When you see someone on a horse, they run into the big top and they're running along a sort of tunnel, aren't they?
Yeah.
So if you were seated in the north side of the tent, you had a problem.
God, yeah.
You can't get out that way. Mm. Of the remaining 5 exits, only 3 of those were big enough to cope with a rush of people.
Sort of, I need to go to the loo halfway through the show kind of exits.
Yeah, little slits, little flaps.
Yeah.
Needless to say, Phil, all hell is breaking loose at this point. There was a man called Donald Gale who was actually at the scene that day, and he described the scene. Phil?
The fire was like a tornado was behind it. It was just very intense, and it just came up extremely fast, and it swept right across us and went over our heads, and it just kept running and going.
As it caught the canvas, it would have rushed across over your head, literally like a wave break over the top.
Yeah, I mean, once it hits anything that's doused in petrol or gasoline, it's just just
yeah,
gone.
Yeah, there's nothing stopping that fire whatsoever. So what was happening at this point was that people were rushing to get out. Now, the logical thing to do here was to head for the centre ring where the performance would usually be.
Yes, because you're actually further away from the canvas in the centre, aren't you? And there's more room.
I mean, it seems counterintuitive now because you think get out of the tent, but it's the sides of the tent that are burning. So you'd run to the centre.
Mm.
Now, unfortunately, around the ring were hundreds of folding chairs. Now, so as people stampeded down from the outside seating areas,
which are like wooden rows,
as people stampeded down those wooden rows, they were tripping over the chairs, and those tripped people were causing more trips, and pile-ups started occurring. So people are surging down into the centre, tripping over the chairs, and then they're getting trampled on as other people fall over them. An implosion, really, of people towards the centre of the tent.
Jesus.
Now, factor into this the flames, the smoke, the heat, the shouting and the screaming, and you could describe this as absolute hell on earth. It's chaos. Immediately, it's chaos.
And this would have happened in minutes, if
I mean, seconds. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Because it's a wave of fire over your head. Everyone surges forwards into a mass of people into the in the centre of the ring.
Jesus.
Now, remember, as we said earlier, 2/3 of the audience were women and children. Well, not very nice to say, but in a stampede, it's smaller people, weaker people who tend not to fare too well. And that was the case here. So it meant that it was mainly children who were being trampled by adults. So there was a survivor on that day, a man called Elliot Smith, and he was one of the children who had become trapped under a pile of people in the stampede to get out. And he said, Phil,
I could feel the weight of the people on top of me, and I could hear people screaming and praying. Then the screaming stopped and the praying stopped.
Another survivor, Carol Parrish, who was 6 at the time of the disaster, later said, Phil,
until this day, I can smell the stench of human flesh.
So this is a bad one, okay? It's a really bad one, right? Like I say, it has all of the elements of some of the worst ones we've ever done. If this was TV in the 80s and I was Michael Parkinson, I would now be saying, it's time to put the children to bed, okay? Because it doesn't get much nicer from this point. Okay. Now, don't forget to throw into the mix lots of terrified animals outside the tent, and panicking roaming elephants are all mixed up into this absolute insanity.
Yeah, because you've got all the staff are just trying their best to do everything they can to get this fire out. Sort of elephants just go, just let them wander.
So by now, the flames are all over the canvas top, up the sides, across the roof, everywhere. Now, the sheer velocity of that fire meant that the flames were eating away at the guy ropes that were supporting the beams and physically holding the tent up.
Right.
I mean, let's not forget the weatherproofing solution on the tent is making the tent go up like a torch.
Oh, God, yeah.
It was not just petrol, like we said, on that tent. It's also paraffin wax. And when the paraffin wax was set fire to and melted, it started falling in boiling globules from the roof.
Oh, just like molten rain.
Molten rain, essentially. And they were falling on people and burning their hair and burning their clothes. And there were also large pieces of flaming canvas raining down. They're in the centre of a conflagration.
So even if you're going to the centre because you think that's a sensible thing, you have got paraffin wax and bits of flaming canvas raining down on you, touching your skin. Oh, God, it's just awful.
Yes, burning rain. Now, although most of the audience were able to escape the fire, many of them weren't. Witnesses later said that some people simply ran around in circles trying to find their loved ones rather than trying to escape from the burning tent. I don't know what you would be like in that situation, but fucking hell. Other people escaped, but then ran back into the fire to look for family members and then were never seen again. And some people simply just stayed in their seats until it was too late. They just stayed. Partly, I imagine, because they assumed the fire would be put out and they didn't want to be part of the chaos, or just sheer rabbit in the headlights shock.
Oh, it's horrible. This is what I felt like when I was researching this. Every time I came across something like this, I was just like, almost had to sort of step away from the computer for a bit because I was like, this is just so horrible. I just try and get your head around it all.
So horrible. After 10 minutes of burning, the poles that supported the tent were burned, right? Which meant that the whole of the 19-ton big top crashed down on those who hadn't already escaped. Outside, those who have managed to get out could hear the people inside. These people are being burned to death. Now, remember the clown we mentioned earlier, Emmett Kelly. Mm. He said later that the sounds he heard from the burning tent were something that could never be forgotten.
It's just, it can't, you can't even imagine this. It's just, it's too horrific.
Emmett Kelly, the clown, I can't even believe I'm going to read this out. Amongst the streams of children, said Emmett Kelly, he could hear cries of mercy and screams of mummy.
Oh, God.
I mean,
that's it, isn't it? That's as bad as it gets.
It feels like we're approaching the edge. We're approaching the edge of what we can say on a comedy podcast, I think.
Approaching.
There was, I do think this is the closest we've got to the edge of what was possible to say, I think. Anyway, okay. Anyway, I'm in for a penny. Now, incidentally, there is a famous photograph of this disaster that shows Kelly in full clown costume, in full makeup, rushing towards the tent with a bucket of water to help extinguish the fire. And obviously, we'll put the picture up on the Instagrams. It was a photo that was published in Life magazine a couple of weeks after the disaster. And it is an insane photograph.
It's mad because obviously he's in full clown makeup with a bucket of water, which is something that you would see a clown do in his normal job. But the nature of his clown character is somebody who always looked very sad in tattered clothing. But then behind it, you've got this burning skeleton of the Big Top. And obviously he's rushing with a bucket of water to try and help. It's just everything amalgamated into this just bizarrest photograph. But yeah, we'll put it up. But it's horrendous, really.
It's weird because it's part of it is the incongruity of it in that, you know, it's a clown trying to put out a fire and he slaps shoes and all the rest of it. But also, the clown with the bucket is the act, right? It's like they always are pouring buckets of water over each other. There's so many things about this disaster which are painfully ironic, horribly ironic, if you see what I mean. Almost like dark jokes. It really feels like a horrible prank. Do you know what I mean? Like a horrifying cosmic prank.
Well, it's weird that we sort of said at the beginning, we know we're not talking about the war, but essentially you've got the machinations and the hoo-ha of the war means that the trains are all a little bit screwed, and that means that they arrive late, that means this happened. You know, it's a Tenerife thing again, isn't it? This led to this, this led to this.
One thing leads to another. Well, Phil, yes, so this is all absolutely horrendous, awful. What was the direct aftermath of all of this absolute horror?
The official death toll was 168 people. That is a mixture of asphyxiation, being burned or being crushed to death. And that roughly broke down as about 100 children and 70 adults. Now, that figure was arrived at by including a collection of body parts that were recovered that were simply listed as victim, because you're not, as horrendous as it is, you're not necessarily dealing with just dead bodies. You're dealing with what's left of a body. It's horrendous.
Yeah.
And kind of because of that, some say that the real figure would have been much higher than this, but 168 is what the official toll said.
I mean, you're dealing with a mangle, aren't you? A mangle of people.
Exactly, and that is borne out by what the firefighters who were on the scene said. Because now, remember that we said those two north side exits were blocked off by the cage tunnels for the animals to get in and out. Well, it was at those two X's that most of the bodies were found.
Because they were trying to get out, and because they were by the canvas.
Yeah, exactly. They couldn't get out because the animal cages were blocking the exits, essentially.
And again, that feeds into this horrific cosmic joke type thing, doesn't it? That there's a big door there and they run to the door, and what are they confronted with? A fucking cage. Do you know what I mean? There's so many parts of it which are just a slap in the face, you know.
Honestly, I genuinely were sort of researching this. I had to keep coming away from the computer for a bit because I was just like, oh God, this is awful.
Well, do you know what? I'm surprised, man, because like, I think I'm not sure if before you'd done the research for it, because this episode was recommended by a listener. And I wonder if we had found this on our own and then you'd done the research, I wonder if we would have even done this one?
I looked at it and just went circus, fire, juxtaposition between something horrific, something supposed to be fun, kind of in keeping with what we've done. And I thought, okay. And then I got onto it and yeah. I was just like, it's just got worse and worse and worse. So, yeah. So firefighters on the scene later said that around those two exits that were blocked, there were bodies that were just like chunks of black coal that were fused together, and they had to actually break them apart in their attempts to look for any survivors that might possibly be under all this carnage and mess. I mean,
fucking hell.
In addition to the 168 fatalities, a further 700 people were treated for injuries. Now, the number of actual injuries is believed to be higher than that because many people just got out the tent, went straight home in shock. So God only knows what sort of mental trauma they had to deal with in the subsequent months and years.
That's interesting, isn't it? You never think about that. That happened with the old roller coaster crash we did, didn't it? That people just went home.
Yeah.
And then when times changed in like the 90s or something, they went to a psychiatrist and went, I've been having nightmares for the last fucking 30 years.
Yeah. So I would imagine that there are people out there to this day, because there would have been people in the audience who are still alive today. You know, children would still be, they'd be obviously elderly yeah. now, but they would still be, there would be people alive. So God only knows. And also, you know, when we say injuries, you focus a lot on the number of deaths, and you sort yeah. of, you hear a figure for injuries, but it doesn't mean these injuries, that we're not talking about light scratches and...
Yeah, these are third degree burns, yeah.
We're talking about burnings, we're talking about amputations, we're talking just... This is beyond horrendous. I mean, on the plus side, Phil, no animals died.
That is amazing, isn't it? Because
yeah.
when I was reading through this, I imagined, oh, you know, we're going to get to the point where we talk about the horrible things that happened to the lions, the horrible things that happened to the elephants. But yeah, one very small respite is the fact that no animals died.
Yeah, I mean, they're all outside the tent. I mean, some of them suffered burns, which is horrible, but I don't think any died, so... Yeah, like you say, if there's any remotely positive thing in any of this, that is the tiny grain.
That's the bit to lull you to sleep. The lions were fine.
Oh, Gargantua got through it. Now, there is a bizarre and quite macabre element that we have to mention here. And that is something called Little Miss 1565. Now, this is particularly horrible, as we're talking about a victim who was a young blonde girl, probably about 11 years old. And a photo of this deceased young girl was released after the tragedy, where she is seen lying, obviously deceased, in a white dress.
Right, outside the tent.
No, you don't see that. You just see a close-up of a young girl lying with her eyes closed in a white dress.
And have you seen this photograph?
Yes, it's quite easy to see this photo. It was released because nobody had come forward to identify it or, you know, say, oh, that's my daughter or anything right. like that. And they were trying to find out who she was. You know, I don't think you would do that in this day and age. In this day and age, you would release a photograph of a dead young girl.
No.
And say, does anyone know who this is? But these were, you know, different times. So they wanted to identify. But anyway, this young girl, because nobody knew who she was called Little Miss 1565. Mm. And 1565 was the number assigned to her in Hartford's temporary morgue.
Right.
Now, there is still debate to this day about who she is, because the body was never claimed at the time.
Sure, she was just on her own.
Yeah, nobody ever claimed her. She ended up being buried in the local cemetery in Hartford.
Right.
And the two police investigators who took the photograph would actually visit the grave regularly to lay flowers. And they both did that until they both died.
Oh.
And after that, a local flower company continued to place flowers on the grave of this little unclaimed girl. It wasn't until 1991 that the body was officially declared to be a young girl called Eleanor Emily Cook, despite the fact that at the time of the tragedy, Eleanor Cook's aunt and uncle had looked at this Little Miss 1565 and declared it not to be Eleanor.
But she's like, she's not burned or anything. She's like,
yeah, you can tell. She just looked, it's just incredibly sad. It just looks like a young girl asleep. There's a little bit of scar. There's a little couple of scars, but it just looks just like a young girl asleep.
So they would have recognised it. There's nothing like
this. No, it's very clear who the person is. We're not going to put a photo like that up, but it is available if you... if you did want to look.
That's so freaky. Do you think they just couldn't deal with it?
I don't know. This is the weird thing. You don't know whether they were in denial or whether they were in such shock they just didn't recognise, or it's really weird. But, you know, even though this girl's Eleanor Cook's aunt and uncle said it wasn't this girl Eleanor, the Connecticut State Police Forensics Unit by the 90s, or sort of late 80s, were pretty sure that it was Eleanor. And because of that, she was exhumed in 1991 and buried next to her brother, Edward, who also died in the circus fire.
That's so mad.
And what gets even madder about this is, you know, there are still some who say that that girl is not Eleanor Cook. And in fact, one of those people is Eleanor's own mother, who maintained until her death in 1997 that that was not her daughter.
But if it was not her daughter, then where's her daughter?
Well, don't forget, there are still, you know, there are still people as of this day who are classed as missing. There are actually five people to this day who are still classed as missing. And don't forget, you're not always dealing with bodies here. You're dealing with remains.
Remains, yeah.
So if this mother is saying, that is not my daughter, and you'll say, well, okay, where is she? She's not necessarily, as in the sort of most horrible way of putting it, she's not necessarily there as somebody who can be claimed.
So she's saying, oh, she did die in the fire, but that isn't her,
essentially. But it's a weird one, because you've got forensic units going, yep, it's her, but then you've got her own mother going, no, that's not her.
That's so weird.
It's really weird, you know. And like I say, you know, there are still five people officially missing from this disaster, and as recently as last year, two bodies were exhumed in an attempt to identify them. So, you know, this is a tragedy that is still having repercussions today, sort of nearly 80 years on.
It's little known here, but is it famous in America? Like, are we doing one? Are we doing an episode of this podcast that Americans are going to be like, oh, mate, don't do that? But, like, because we don't know about it, we've jumped in. We've put our foot in it.
I don't know. I think it is quite well known. I do think it's quite well known, but I don't think it's known in this country at all.
No, not at all. I'd never heard of it. And when you put the picture of the sad clown up on Facebook, we did get a comment underneath saying, oh, fuck, I know what this is.
Mm.
And I was like, I didn't. That picture of that clown didn't ring any bells for me. So
there must have been an investigation, surely.
There is always an investigation, Phil. Just 2 days after the tragedy, charges of involuntary manslaughter were filed against five senior employees of the circus.
Right.
Now, parts of the charges included what was called a lack of preparation, nailed it, on the part of the circus management.
Fair play.
Yeah. It included the circus's fire extinguishers being locked away in the storage crate. I mean, that is a big fucking deal, man. Right?
Yeah.
The circus's own fire trucks were over a quarter of a mile away from the tent at the time of the disaster. And the circus failed to notify the Hartford Fire Department of their arrival at all.
Jesus.
There's a reason why there's a clown in slap shoes trying to put out this fire. It's because these bastards didn't tell anybody, and they put nothing in place at all, right?
So they didn't even tell the fire department that they were intending to perform in front of 7,000 to 8,000 people.
And they didn't tell anybody that they had changed the way that they waterproofed the tent. Within days of those charges, the circus reached an agreement with Hartford officials to accept full financial responsibility and pay whatever amount the city requested in damages. It did result in a situation that by 1954, 10 years after the disaster, the circus had paid out almost $5 million to 600 victims and families who had filed claims against them. That's good, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sort of praising them, but I think there's something to be said that days after the tragedy, the circus just went, yep, you know, we'll accept full responsibility. Whatever you say we have to pay, we pay. It doesn't exonerate them, but it's moving in the right direction.
All circus profits, all, is that true? 100% of circus profits from the time of the fire until 1954 was set aside to pay off the claims.
So they worked for 10 years just for free, just to pay the claims off.
That's actually, I mean, that's great, right?
We've done, like, you know, over 40 episodes of this, and when we've done these disasters where companies are involved, we've had a lot of wrangling. Yeah. This is quite unique in that sense.
Although the circus did accept full responsibility for the financial damages, they didn't accept responsibility for the disaster itself.
How does that work?
I guess no one knows how it started.
Mm. A I see what you mean, yeah.
The five men who were originally charged were brought to trial in late 1944. Four of them were convicted and spent nearly a year in prison before they were pardoned entirely. Mm. One of those men was a chap by the name of James A. Haley, who went on to serve as a Democrat in the US House of Representatives for 24 years.
Yeah, he'd have to be a Democrat, wouldn't he?
Anything to put the boot in. Anyway, over and above all of that, the rights and wrongs of all of that, what was the cause of the accident? Well, the authorities were never able to determine it. There is a weird addition to this, though, Phil, because in 1950, a bloke called Robert Dale Segi,
right,
or Segi, he claimed during a police interview that he was responsible for the circus fire.
Oh, right.
Segi, or Segi, claims to have had a nightmare in which an American Indian rode towards him on a flaming horse and told him to go around starting fires.
This bloke's a nutter.
There are doubts over Segi's confession. He has got a history of mental illness, and it couldn't be proven if he was anywhere near even the state of Connecticut when the fire occurred.
Okay.
But he did cop to it. Additionally, Segi, he died in 1997, but later in life he denied starting the fire. So it sounds to me like maybe he just...
A bit of an unhinged fantasist.
For some reason, people just cop for stuff they haven't done. I don't know. I don't know what the psychological mechanism is that makes people do that, but it happens quite a lot. It should be added, though, that from 1950 to 1972, Segi was in prison for a whole heap of other arson crimes.
Oh.
So it's not like he was a stranger to arson.
Right, so he wasn't just a bit of a weirdo, a guy with problems. He genuinely did go around starting fires.
Yes. He was more of a sort of forgetful arsonist than he was a complete fantasist. Anyway, so to bring this right up to today, in 2004, Phil, a permanent memorial to the disaster was erected where the fire occurred.
Oh, okay, that's nice.
So what happened to the circus, Phil? Like, I imagine did they cease all trading after they paid off the debt?
No, Phil, they carried on with their 1944 season.
You've got overheads, haven't you?
Oh, how could you mentally just carry on? Anyway, they did. But, quite sensibly, Phil, from that day on, they avoided tents, probably because they didn't have one. But yeah. They did all their shows in future in open-air, sort of pre-built arenas. And they kept going as a circus until 2017. And in one of their very final shows, they visited Hartford, Connecticut.
Do you think they did that on purpose? Do you think that was like a pilgrimage?
Yeah, I think so. How many people do you think turned up for that one?
Yeah, low attendance, especially for the matinee, I should have thought. Wow. Well, there we are. That was, the truly awful story of the Hartford Circus Fire of 1944.
Can't pull anything positive out of that. At all.
Lions were fine. The lions were fine.
Maybe that'll be the tagline. The Hartford Circus Fire of 1944. The lions are fine.
The lions were fine. Was it our fault or God's fault, Phil Lucas?
Pretty sure it was entirely the circus's fault. Therefore, that makes it our fault. Yeah, but our fault. Who knows, Phil? Maybe God thinks circuses are as boring as the rest of us do.
I do think God has got a little bit of stuff here. God could have made the trains run on time.
Yeah, of all the things God can do, he can do a Mussolini with a train timetable if he wanted to.
Yes, one of the worst ones ever. If you have been affected by any of the issues raised on today's Crash Bang Wallop, I really don't know what you're going to have to do. Deal with it, I imagine.
Yeah, don't go to the circus. Yeah, I don't know.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode. We have had lots of lovely, lovely reviews since our last episode. I think mainly because we got a shout out on the We Are History podcast, didn't we? Angela Barnes's podcast. Thank you very, very much, Angela. You've brought so hello to new listeners who've come to us from the We Are History pod. And many of those reviews come from them, don't they, Phil, I think?
Yes, so thank you very much for that. And thank you to Angela and John at the We Are History podcast. Genuinely, it's a great podcast. We love it. I listened to the last episode just before lockdown on a trip to Bristol. And the latest episode is about a little micronation just off the coast of Britain called Sealand. And it's genuinely a fabulous episode. So thank you to We Are History Pod. That is a great podcast, one of our favourites. So do give that a listen. But you're right, Phil. We've had lovely reviews. And it always cheers us, doesn't it, of a morning when we check.
Claire in Lincoln. I like a prosaic handle. Claire in Lincoln.
Yeah. Very swap shop.
Yes, Claire in Lincoln. Hello, Claire in Lincoln. Claire in Lincoln says, what a hidden gem. A passing reference to this podcast by Angela Barnes on We Are History brought me here, and I'm so pleased. I only listened to 5 episodes so far, but I'm rubbing my hands together and crackling with glee at the large number awaiting. Thank you, Phil and Phil. I will recommend this podcast to all my listening friends. Thank you so much. That's Claire in Lincoln.
Thank you. That's very, very kind of you. We have got one from Oxnard76.
Oxnard.
sounds like a Blake 7, doesn't it?
I was going to say, Oxnard does sound like a lesser Marvel villain, doesn't it? someone in a big cloak who gets killed off early.
Well, before they were killed off early in a Marvel film, they said, I love learning quirky facts and proper history, but being honest, I'm too lazy to read books, and I've learned all I need to know about Hitler and sharks from Sky already.
I agree, Oxnard76.
This podcast is therefore the perfect alternative. I genuinely learn loads and have a good laugh in the process. The films complement each other perfectly. Comedy-wise, they often rip the piss out of each other. My only issue is it's only once a fortnight and I'm running out of them. Listen now and spread the word. Once a fortnight, that would be the dream.
Oh, that was the dream. That was the dream, wasn't it? Oxnard 76.
It was the dream. We originally wanted to do these every fortnight, but then we found that if we did, we spend our whole life doing podcasts and we don't have time to do anything else.
Thank you very much, Oxnard. Snard. Town map. Town map.
Love a town map.
Town map says, great laugh considering the topics covered. I've accidentally learned quite a bit too. I like the amount of people who say that they accidentally learn stuff. Thank you very much, town map.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for the little kiss you put at the end of your review as well.
Thanks, town map.
That's yeah. Very sweet. Lisa123 says, best podcast out there. These guys make me cry with laughter whilst accidentally educating
again.
Me. Again, accidental. I've got a bloody subscription to the National Newspaper Archives to research this.
Yeah, man.
That's £12 a month. There's bloody grit and determination gone into this. This is no accident. No, thank you very much. All schools should base their lessons on this
Definitely.
Style.
Definitely.
Keep up the good work. Yeah. Now, children, we've got something very exciting to tell you today. It's all about a circus in America. don't have nightmares. Now.
And thank you. Yes. Thank you so much, Lisa. Oh, 1, 2, 3. Zoption. Zoption?
Well, I reckon that's Zoption, yeah.
Zoption. Zoo option. Love it, says Zoption. Found CB Wallop through Angela Barnes again. Thank you so much, Angela, for recommending us. Have basically binge listened to all the episodes while I'm home, along with the kids back in school and with no job to go to. We feel your pain, Zoption. But I love it. Interesting topics, well presented. I love the banter between the films and accidentally learn a lot. Thanks. She didn't. I put in accidentally there. But thank you so much, Zoption.
Thank you.
If you'd like to give us a review, then we will love you to, and we will always read them out. If you want to listen to Angela's podcast, then absolutely do that, because it's also awesome. I think probably we'll try and come back with a bit of a knockabout one next time. What do you think?
Yeah, I think we should. I think we should. This guy quite got us down, this one.
But this one did come in through a recommendation of a listener. So please do. We've done a few recommendations now. So if you do have a recommendation, especially actually, I really feel like we need to do Australia, New Zealand. We need to do somewhere from around there, I think.
Well, fortunately, a couple of very dear listeners have actually recommended something in New Zealand, which I'm going to have a look into.
Was that the bridge collapse?
Yes, so we'll look into that. I'm really sorry I can't remember off the top of my head the name of the person who recommended this podcast, but we will dig that out and we'll thank them. So
yes, thank you so much for recommending it, because I think even though it's been really horrid, it has pushed us to the limit of what might be acceptable. So it's nice to know. It's nice to know where that edge is, isn't
yeah,
it?
We found the red line.
I think we've found it. You know, if this one goes over okay, then I think we know where the line is, I think. All right, lovely. Thank you so much for listening to this harrowing episode of the Crash Bang Wallop podcast. If you're in England, I hope that your lockdown is going well. And if you're in America, congratulations on your new dawn. For Lucas, have you got anything to add?
No.
Oh, lovely. Thank you so much for listening to the Crash Bang Wallop podcast this week. We will see you next time with something slightly more knockabout. Thank you millions and millions. We'll see you next time.
Bye!